The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guest this evening. Born in Philadelphia with roots in South Africa and Trinidad, Zinzi Clemens is co-founder and former publisher of Apogee Journal and a contributing editor for LitHub. She received a BA in critical theory and literary arts from Brown and an MFA in fiction from Columbia. She teaches literature and creative writing at the Colburn Conservatory and Occidental College. Inspired by her own life, her debut novel follows a woman caught between cultures as she struggles with love and the loss of the person who shaped her the most. Paul Beatty, this year's Man Booker Prize winner, says the book signals the emergence of a voice that refuses to be ignored and reads like a guided tour through a melancholic Van Gogh exhibit, wonderfully chromatic, transfixing, and bursting with emotion. Please welcome Zinzi Clemens to the stage.
Hi, everybody. I'm well. I am so happy, and this is totally surreal to be up here. I've been in the audience more times than I can remember, and have seen some people that I really admire read here, and it's just a total honor to be able to now be here and to read for you guys. This is my third reading. I did two others in Los Angeles, and I decided to start with a political screed of sorts, and I will not do that tonight. I will just launch right into the book. Maybe that's disappointing or a relief, I don't know. But we can save the political question and answer till the end. I'm happy to answer anything, any questions you guys have about this book or any of my other writing. To kind of jump into the novel, I'm going to read a section from the middle of the book, and it starts right at the beginning of part two. And this may seem like a spoiler, especially if you haven't heard, if you haven't read a description of the book, but it's not. And the reason for that is, in the description, we know what happens. The mother dies, and that is what's going to happen in the section I'm going to read to you. But the reason why this is not a spoiler is because this is not a chronological book. So most novels that you will read sort of go forward in time from, you know, January, February, March, December, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. But the way that I wrote this book was to sort of make it based on topical associations. So if you can imagine a narrator, a protagonist in the present tense, and when we begin this book, in the prologue, the narrator, Tandi, is speaking to her father, and at the end she throws up, which is an indication that she's pregnant. So she is just on the cusp of learning that she is with child, and that's where the present is. And from there, because she is thinking about starting her own family, these memories of her mother are jogged. And so I kind of go from one topic to the next as they're related. And this sort of mimics the way that memory works, right? So especially when we go through a traumatic experience like the loss of someone especially close to us, we tend to think in that way. Smells jog memories, songs jog memories, and they take us from one place to the next. And in this book, those memories lead the protagonist and the narrator back in time to this very traumatic experience. One thing to note, I will begin with a scene about character Amina, who is Tandi's best friend from childhood. And I will start there. Amina and Frank had been broken up for a month when she called to tell me that she was pregnant and needed an abortion. At the time, things were okay between them, and Frank had visited her in New York. They returned to her house from a party where Frank was talking to another girl. When they came home, Amina fucked him with all her might, desperate for his attention, and afterwards she collapsed in a ball next to him, crying, drunk, in the dark. She picked a fight with him and threw him out, and he rode the bus back to D.C. in the middle of the night. They hadn't spoken in 2 weeks. I caught the train up to New York that weekend. We walked to the clinic, past picketers in front, and I helped her separate her belongings at the metal detector. We were led into a cold linoleum waiting room. I took notes for her during the consultation with the nurse practitioner. As we approached the doors to the operating area, she asked the nurse's aide, "Can she come with me?" The aide refused, gently as she could, so I held Amina's hand until I couldn't anymore. I waved to her through the swinging door. Afterward, she told me three other women were in the recovery room with her, two black and one white. The procedures had been completed in separate rooms, and at the end, they all ended up in one waiting room. The women who received anesthesia were worse than the others. They were confused, getting up and falling to the ground. Amina was awake the whole time. The procedure didn't hurt, she said, and the people were as nice and thorough as could be. But there was no getting around the discomfort. When it was over, they sat clutching their stomachs, and Amina kept thinking about what color hair the baby would have had. Would it have looked more like Frank or like her? She didn't cry, though another woman did. The other, dazed from the drugs, inquired repeatedly about a bus schedule. None of the other women had anyone waiting for them. Amina said that she wasn't sad. We never raised the morality of the action, because our politics took care of that. Neither of us believed that a fetus legally constituted a human life. But Amina still cried as if she had lost something, and I had to tell her that she was wrong, that it was nothing to begin with. Yet part of me doubted that statement, because I was smart enough to believe that nothing on this earth could be completely knowable. That little tadpole could have feelings, and there could be a God, and we could have angered God with what we did that day. What I knew for sure was that if I had been in Amina's shoes, I would have chosen the same thing, and I would have mourned the same way she did. And I would have wished, against the futility of such thoughts and acceptance of my decision, that it hadn't happened in the same way that I knew she did. When I finally got her back into bed and fed her painkillers along with canned tomato soup, Amina started crying, harder than I had ever seen her cry, even harder than the time she broke her ankle at Camp Field Day in third grade, and you could see the bone poking through her skin. "I love Frank," she wailed over and over, "and he's going to hate me for this." I told her she didn't know that he would, but she decided to keep it a secret anyway. She never told him, and 3 months later, they were back together for good. My mother was completely exhausted in the first few weeks after treatment. She needed someone to bring her lunch during the day, to remind her to take her medicine, and to sit and watch television with her. I was home from college for the summer and played her caretaker. For most of the day, she sat alone in my parents' bed in the same position, hugging a body pillow, her head angled toward the television. She wore a stocking cap and her old cotton pajamas. Her treatment center was in the middle of one of Philadelphia's most expensive neighborhoods. The building was a classic stone-fronted townhouse that overlooked a small park. It looked like a mansion, offering an opulence I imagined to be comforting to my mother. But that was one thing we never talked about, the apparent muddiness of her treatment. It was something she knew her friends couldn't afford, and for that I think she felt guilty. She told me that, surprisingly to her, most of the people in her chemo center were black. I was surprised as well, but I never revealed as much. I thought of a friend's mom, whom I knew from elementary school, and the people in the ads and brochures for cancer foundations. They had a look, older, round, rose-cheeked, what little hair they had graying and mostly white. No, my mother said. In her center, they were mostly black men and women, quite a few of them young, in their 30s and 40s, working to middle class. Many brought their children to treatment because the kids didn't have anywhere else to go. She told me about one woman in her support group who had no family, no friends willing to take her in or help her. It was just her and her daughter, the woman said, and she cried and cried. I never told my mother that. Until then, I had thought of cancer as a disease of privilege. I hated how it had been elevated above and beyond all other diseases. I hated the ribbons, the bracelets, the ubiquitous awareness campaigns, the constant sponsorships. Another thing I wouldn't tell her. Since starting college, I hadn't admitted to anyone that she had cancer. I didn't want anyone's pity. My classmates and I theorized enthusiastically about the AIDS movement and how disease had taken the place of dictators in post-colonial Africa. I could not admit to my friends that my family was benefiting so heavily from first world wealth. They thought that in Africa we lived in huts and played with elephants, and I did nothing to disabuse them of that notion. Dirty and inconvenient, AIDS was a disease of the people, I thought. Cancer, to me, was the opposite. Its cause was endorsed and healthily sponsored. But I never admitted to my mother what I thought of her disease, that thing she lived with day and night that was more present to her than us, than even God. Unlike family or faith, her disease was something she had never chosen. When I came close to telling her, I remembered that, and it rendered me silent. What I felt was extremely uncomfortable, and she would have resented me for it. As much as she suffered, many other people were suffering worse. Her disease only reinforced how the world saw us, not black or white, not American or African, not poor or rich. We were confined to the middle and would always be. As hard as she tried to separate herself from the binds of apartheid, we were still within its grip. It had become the indelible truth of our lives, and nothing, not sickness, not suffering, not death, could change that. While she was in bed drifting in and out of sleep, I sat alone in the kitchen. The kitchen in their apartment was modern and open, with an Eden island in the center of the room, the seats facing the oven and fridge. All of the appliances were stainless steel, the countertops granite. Every day I sat there in the company, only of those appliances and the sounds that they made. A bathroom was just off the kitchen, so I didn't need to leave the space at all during the day except to shower. For most of those 4 weeks, that was what I did. Every morning, I set my laptop on the island and did not leave except to bring my mother her meals. I rarely worked or wrote emails. I avoided anything that would connect me with the outside world, which felt too out of control. Instead, I retreated into the apartment and watched the world go by like a parade. The kitchen was my world. I ate gluttonously and gained 10 pounds. I passively read my emails. Most were from college, asking me to choose my classes, to sign up for health insurance. I let the deadlines pass and later received red-lettered alerts from deans and other administrators. I began to enjoy taking those multiple choice surveys on the internet. What movie star's hair do you have? What movie is your love life? My mother refused to go outside except for doctor's appointments. Her pills didn't seem to help the pain. The only things I could give her were her meals. The refrigerator was the center of my kitchen world. It sat right across from me, about as tall as a regular human, and when the radio was off, its hum was the only sound in the room. When I first arrived back home, I cleaned it out furiously, tossing all the old takeout boxes and the stagnant leftovers of curries and meats. I threw away anything with a large amount of oil or fat and duplicates of condiments, extra bottles of ketchup, mustard, mayonnaise. I scrubbed every shelf and surface until the inside gleamed. I restocked the fridge with healthy foods, fruits, vegetables, yogurts, soy milk, probiotic this and that. When it was done and the fridge was filled with vibrant colors and smelled of Lysol, I felt lifted, hopeful. I understood then, awash in unfiltered refrigerator light, that this was how I was going to cure my mom with whole grains and elbow grease. But one by one, the old food reinvaded the fridge. Every visitor who came by, and there were many, brought us a different dish: curries, stews, fried rice. the things that were meant to stick to the bones, to comfort, the foods my mother, loved best. Friends gave them to us in their own pots with no mention of when the pots should be returned. During my second week back home, my mom's best friend stopped by. She brought us a pork roast, mashed potatoes, and beans, all wrapped in tin foil. She gave them to me to pack in the fridge. I had to take my vegetables out of the crisper and set them in the fruit bowl in the middle of the island, defenseless. I took the huge tin foil packages, the grease beginning to leak through, and shoved them in the spotless drawer. I slammed the door shut and ran straight to the spare bedroom. I locked myself inside, buried my face in the pillows, and cried. A week before I was supposed to begin college again, I called the dean's office and told the administration I wouldn't be coming for next semester. "You'll be returning after that," my father commanded. "Yes," I said, but the truth was that I didn't know anything for sure anymore. A story came up on the local news about a murder not far from our house in a much rougher neighborhood where this type of thing was ordinary, almost expected. The news was filled with stories from those blocks, faces of its children alternately lost, made criminal, locked away. They showed a man's picture. He was dark-skinned, with a white beard and white eyebrows, a friendly smile. He looked around my mother's age. He was a mail carrier for a neighborhood in the South. He went out in the morning to work, and on his way to the subway, he was jumped by two thieves. He refused to give up his wallet and cell phone, and they shot him. He died on the sidewalk. My mother turned to me with surprising calm. She spoke as if she were discussing someone else's life, someone else's mother. "He's just like me," she mused. "I'll die too. It's just that how I'll go is more decided." "Yes," I said, and we turned back to the news. More deaths, more robberies. Life went on. And then just a couple more. My father and I didn't communicate much except to coordinate nurse visits for my mother or to give updates on her medicines. We were holding so much in, our pain distinct from each other's in many ways. I suppose we thought that if we ever acknowledged this, all our carefully assembled control would fall to pieces. I was terrified of his pain, that of losing a lifelong partner, so many years tossed out the window. And I'm sure he feared the destabilization of my loss. How much of my life yet to live would be marred by this? Because my father was a man and relatively young, a part of me was scared that he would leave. That was always the fear with men. I suppose this was a part of the not talking, the not crying. I thought that if I didn't acknowledge the horror we were living in, it somehow wouldn't be as bad and he would stay. But day after day, he didn't leave. And his eyes never wavered from my mother when she was wheeled out of the hospital or lifted into the car or when she was being sutured or changed or intubated. So many times when I couldn't look anymore, he did. That night, I didn't eat. I collapsed early and slept into the late morning. My father spent the night at the hospital with my mother while I rested at home. My father called from the hospital in the morning to say that she had had an accident. He was in the hospital room waiting with the nurses to decide their next move. He lowered his voice so that no one else could hear. "Can you bring me a change of clothes?" he said. She had urinated on the bed and her clothes, and when he tried to clean the mess before the nurses came in, it got all over him. His voice cracked, and he began to cry. He put the phone down. I packed him a shirt and a sweater from his closet and some new pants from his drawer. I headed to the hospital, fighting off the image of my mother and father covered in her piss. By the time I arrived, they had fitted her with a catheter. "No more accidents," the male nurse said, smiling, trying to be upbeat. I imagined the painful method by which he had connected the catheter to her bladder. From the bottom of her blanket ran a tube that connected to a clear plastic container at the foot of the bed. I sat in a chair by her side while my dad changed in the bathroom in the hall. When he returned, the doctors told us she wouldn't wake up after this. I wondered if she could hear, if she knew what was going on, and I decided it was better if she didn't. I decided not to think anymore. I stared at the urinal, the tubing, not watching, not reacting. The room smelled acrid because she had an infection, which was what was forcing her into a coma. I let the smell overwhelm me until I couldn't smell it anymore. The stench was nothing more than molecules moving in and out of my nostrils. The scene nothing more than light reflected off objects alive and inanimate, some dying. And then just two more pages. We moved her to a hospice in downtown Philadelphia, across the street from one of the cafes I used to visit when I was a teenager. She was taken there from the hospital by ambulance by two young women around my age, one of them larger, darker skinned, with hair gelled to her forehead and plastic-looking curly cues. They wore smiles to which I had no concept of how to respond and joked in a careful way with me and my dad. I imagine them being trained to handle families with extreme sensitivity. You can use humor, but not too much. Stick to neutral subjects, nothing controversial. My father rode in the ambulance while I waited outside the hospital under the neon emergency sign. After I'd spent 20 minutes in the cold, my mother's best friend pulled up in front of me in her old Chrysler. She cried as she turned the wheel, almost running red lights. We didn't speak. Her car smelled stale of smoke. The oldies station played on the radio, Al Green beneath a light layer of static. The hospice was a new place on the top floor of a cold brick building with few windows. When we arrived, a tie-dyed social worker tried to steer me into a cheerily lit kids' room. The staff had a phrase for what was happening to my mom, the dying process. And they said the words like they should be followed by a TM, like she was in the process of walking to the store or buying groceries, just another thing that humans do. While my father was out grabbing us prepared sandwiches for dinner, I crept into her room. I closed the door and shoved a chair against the doorknob so no one could enter. I had many things I wanted to say. Some sleepless nights ago, I'd made a list of all the things I needed to apologize for, all the things I needed to tell her I forgave her for. But as I stood there with those mathematics in hand, the weight of the moment on me, I said nothing. And when I tried to speak, only tears came. The pain was exponential, because as much as I cried, she could not comfort me, and this fact only multiplied my pain. I realized that this would be life, to figure out how to live without her hand on my back, her soft, accented English telling me, "Everything will be all right, Tondi." This was the paradox. How would I ever heal from losing the person who healed me? The question was so enormous that I could see only my entire life and everything I know filling it. And I'll end there.
Zinzi, thank you for that beautiful, precise, strong-voiced reading. Folks, you probably know how this works. Raise your hand. We'll get a microphone to you. Please wait for the microphone and ask your question in the form of a question. Who would like to start us off?
My question is that during that period, those three periods that you brought up with that young lady, what personality trait would you describe that person going through at that particular time, the victim of that, the abortion and that sort of thing, and the young and the mother? What would you describe? Would you describe her as being grunt and upset, or before the fact she getting in a coma? How would you look at that?
Sorry, I need to clarify. So you're asking about Amina, the character who has the abortion, or both of them. So what were the underlying emotions for those characters in that first scene that I read?
If
I may sort of analyze your question, I think maybe what you're getting at is the sort of moral ambiguity to that scene, which was very much intentional, right? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. I'm not sure how, because I didn't
read
the book.
So I'll just talk about that.
Yeah.
Hopefully it sounds good. So I really wanted to write that scene, and people have made comparisons as, like, you know, this is alternative motherhood, abortion, right? This is a book about mothers. And that wasn't really my intention at all. That actually came from a political place, and I think actually it kind of suffices well for my political screed. What was behind that scene is abortion, obviously, is an incredibly divisive topic in our country, and it's been made so by politicians who have very little interest in the women who it actually affects. So what I was trying to show in that scene was basically the kind of bind that those two women are caught up in. So Amina could envision having a child with her partner, and in fact, you know, they end up together later on. They're a long-term couple. At the same time, it's not something that's right for her life at the time, and that's why you hear Tandi going through all of these various contradictions and sort of saying, well, I would have perhaps done it this way, but I couldn't. And we really are caught in those positions by this trap that is created for us by politics, right? And one thing that I think is probably especially relevant today with the current climate is, you know, there are all these, since the election, there have been all of these discussions and debates about how we address politics and how we have conversations between people who disagree so much. What was really important to me in that scene was acknowledging feelings that go beyond politics, right?
Yes.
And I think that when we talk about political debate, the way that you engage in debate is that you have to acknowledge and sort of anticipate any criticism that would come from the opposite side. And in order to do that, you have to acknowledge all of the various contradictions in your argument. And that's basically what I was doing there, was acknowledging the contradictions. So we have the political layer, we have a personal layer, we have a metaphysical layer. And every woman must really contend with those various layers when we decide whether to have a child or not. And I think when we're talking about something like abortion, it actually strengthens our arguments when we acknowledge all of those layers and the complexity of the issue, because then you can really start to have a genuine debate and actually probably win it when we acknowledge everything that's sort of encapsulated in the issue. So,
Zinzi, when you're trying to acknowledge all those levels, does that make it more challenging to get the fiction created and across? Having to accommodate all of those levels that you want to have the text include, and to do that in fiction rather than, say, a nonfiction.
I think actually that's kind of the mode in which I work with everything. I think you saw a similar technique through the rest of the vignettes that I read. Is one thing that. Part of the way that I approach fiction is to really pick apart issues, and especially issues that we assume to be accepted assumptions in our culture. That's really what excites me, is being able to do that kind of close study in fiction. And I'm sure, you know, we'll have more questions about the fiction-nonfiction divide, but I think fiction really allows you to work even closer at the level of detail because you're not restricted by what actually happened in the past. So what I did there in that first scene was it was completely invented. And my personal experience would not have allowed me to delve that deep. But what I did was I did a lot of research, and I spoke to, in particular, a friend of mine who's now an abortion rights activist. And I was able to construct that scene and say what I wanted to say But if I had been working from a nonfiction place or writing an essay, I wouldn't have been able to say the same thing.
Could you talk a little bit about the form of the novel? It's an unusual form, not only because of the short vignettes, but because those are also interspersed with photographs and sort of drawings and graphs and excerpts from articles. And I'm curious about sort of what the initial seed was and how you developed the form of this novel as it grew.
Yeah, so I started writing in college. I started writing in creative writing classes. And when I started writing, at the same time I was studying, I was in a course of study called Modern Culture and Media, which is basically a critical theory approach to media and film studies. Was formerly called semiotics, if you've heard of that. And I was basically working at the very contemporary postmodern end of the spectrum. And that's really, again, that was where I started writing. So I started from a place of experimentation and freedom. And that's really, I think people find it hard to believe, but that's really how I've always written. I've sometimes toggle back and forth, and I had a difficult time writing a novel in this form because I had an idea that a novel should have a beginning, middle, and end, and I had to really fight against that. But I actually, some of my earlier short stories are much more out there than this is, and I have always, in those stories, I actually like made my own graphics. There are a couple in here that are made like on Microsoft Word and like a scanner. but I've always worked with visual elements, and part of that is my own background. I have, when I was in high school and college, I drew a lot. I was a visual artist. I've done a lot of graphic design and production, and so it's always a part of the question to me when I'm writing, not just what the words are and what their meanings are, but also how they appear on the page and what the reading experience is. So I thought a lot about the pause that would be created from reading something and then turning the page. That gives you another couple of seconds for the thing to sink in. And it's sort of like, you can think of it like a line break in poetry. And because I've always worked on books and I've always been visual, I've always thought about how those elements work together. So short answer, that's just my style.
Hi, Zanzi.
Hello, stranger.
First, I just want to quickly say that those of us in this room who've known you all your life, you have no idea how incredibly proud we are of you.
You make me cry. Thank you.
And it's such an honor just to be here to witness this. And,
Thank you.
And I'd be remiss if I didn't just let you know that your mother and all the ancestors are extremely beaming with pride at this very moment. So thank you for sharing that. But my question to you is this. You talked about...
Here it comes.
You know, huh? you talked about just the process of putting the novel together and some of the things that you had to navigate just in terms of structure and that. I'm more curious, rather, about the characters themselves. Mm-hmm. And at what point in that process did the characters become alive and take over, or at least dictate the direction? In your descriptions, you talked about things like, you know, even the hairstyle of some of the lady driving the ambulance, and, you know, just your father lowering his voice at the time when he asked you to bring a change of clothes. So those things speak specifically to the individual themselves, and it's very... You know, I don't know that you could order those steps, or did you order the steps of what those characters were and how they were? How did the characters come alive for you in the process?
So I think the best way to answer this question is to quickly go into teacher mode. And what I always tell my students is that the best way to write a character is to just think of somebody from real life and just copy down what they say. Because characters are really based on those contradictions. And like you said, I like the example of like the father lowering his voice, those kinds of things that often, if you're trying to invent something, you would not I think I actually did invent that, but it was something that I'd seen happen before. And basically the way that I think every fiction writer writes characters is a composite of different people that they know, different things that they've observed. The hardest character to create in this book was Tondi. And in particular, some of the later sections of the book where she's contemplating motherhood and thinking about those things herself. I've never interacted hugely with. I've never really even babysat anyone. That took a lot more research. So I did a lot of reading and like watching videos of women who had just discovered they were pregnant and some like blog posts and things like that. I think, you know, the most important thing probably when we're talking about characters is to make sure that they're unmediated, right? Those are the quirks and contradictions. That's the lowering of the voice thing. And I think wherever you can kind of get that, wherever you can get that unexpected quality, usually it's from life itself, but to kind of pursue those things that would surprise a reader is really how you go about doing it, and just kind of putting as many in as you can.
My question is, it was a line you read, I hope I didn't mishear you, but it's something like, unlike her family and faith, she didn't choose her disease. Can you explain to me what you meant by that?
I'm not sure that there's a deeper meaning there.
Okay, I have a different question.
Okay.
I'll take that.
I'm just trying to answer honestly.
I just wanted to know, what was your mother's faith?
Okay. Well, first of all, you know, this is a novel, so a lot of the parts that I read were happened mostly because, sort of like I just said, you know, when you're writing about these experiences to get at, to really make it ring true, you do need to work from life. And so some of these parts were things that I wrote down while I was actually going through this experience myself. And the character that is created in this book is, none of these characters are exactly like people in my life. So the character of Tondi's mom, do I say it? I don't think I say it. Maybe I mentioned church, but I think I imagine them to be generally religious. And, you know, sometimes I think of religious people because I'm not religious at all. But I sometimes separate people who go to church for more community reasons than perhaps spirituality reasons. And I think that's probably what I had in mind here. Not for religion to be like an over-present thing, but more just to say that it's sort of something immovable in her life, you know, because we don't choose our health. It's, you know, it's one of the scariest things in life is that you can be healthy one day and the next just completely not. And it's, as we're seeing now, really more than we have in a long time, it's a great equalizer. And so that's what I meant by that, is that we just don't have a choice with our health.
Good evening, Zinzi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. What obstacles or challenges did you face in bringing this work and making it a reality, from the seed of the idea to making it a reality, and how did you overcome them?
Oh, countless. Well, first of all, this book started off as a different book. It was a linear chronological narrative, a more traditional novel. And I was writing it, and I just couldn't connect close enough with the characters, and it wasn't really working. But at the same time that I was writing that book, I had just gone through this experience in my life, and So these parts kept coming up, were much like some of the ones I just read, that were really, really raw and really real. And so at some point I showed that manuscript to my agent, and she said, "I'm sorry, this is not good, except for these parts right here." And it was only a handful of pages, and I had written over 100. So that was really, really hard. I just had to throw most of it in the trash, and I did that 3 times in my career. So I started writing in college. I'm 32. It's been about over 10 years, you know, from first attempting to write a novel until this one. And I think one of the biggest challenges was teaching myself how to write a novel, how to write my novel, right? Every writer has to figure out what their specific story is and how to tell it in a specific way. And I think probably because my style is more unconventional, I had a harder time accepting that that was what I was doing. But I'd say that was number one in terms of setbacks, was having to throw everything in the garbage and start over. But other than that, a lot of rejection and a lot of waiting and a lot of self-doubt. That's part of every writer's life and probably every artist's life. And I think probably the most surprising thing about being here is that as a writer, you prepare yourself for a lifetime of rejection and to never, ever be successful. So when the book started getting traction and people started liking it, no one was more surprised than I was, and still, you know. So, yeah, dealing with that has been really weird. But thank you for being here.
I was curious, early in the book you have one of your characters talk about a C.L.R. James Minty Alley. And you put that in there in a natural way. But as soon as I read that, I asked my brother, what audience, this is my question to you, what audience did you have in mind when you wrote the book?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And there's another contradiction sort of behind that, because I think the best way to approach writing is to write as if no one is ever going to read it. So that I do that really whenever I sit down to write anything. But at the same time, I have a certain standard in my mind, a certain sort of level of intelligence and background that I want to make sure I kind of clear, because I don't like the idea of talking down to a reader. And I guess I sort of figured out that my audience, and I think this is actually, but I think it's actually true of everyone, I think you're really writing to yourself and to your own standard. At the same time, when you're a black woman, and a young black woman especially, that becomes a complicated proposition, right? Because no one will admit that there is a black audience that is sizable. We're usually told that we have to write towards a white audience. And so you're absolutely right. I did put in details like that to sort of signal to people like me that this book is for them. And so that was a really important part of it for me, was to write a book that that people like me would read and see something of themselves in. So that was intentional. Yeah.
Mission accomplished. Please join me in thanking Zinzi Clements. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.